with Dad on the Air.
Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 22nd of September 2007. Got an interesting show coming up with Mary Cleary from Ireland. We've got an interview with her. She runs Amen. It's one of the world's leading organisations for dealing with men coping with domestic violence. Should be a fascinating interview. There's absolutely no equivalent of Mary over here in Australia, and she's one of the world's leaders in this area. That'll be a fascinating interview. We also, if we overcome our technical difficulties, we'll have Joshua Key. He's the author of The Deserter's Tale, Why I Walked Away from the War in Iraq. It's an absolutely fascinating book about how he went to Iraq and was absolutely horrified by what he saw happening there, and he came back to America and then fled his own country, and it's a riveting tale of how he put his family, including three young children, into a car and drove across the border into America. He would have faced jail and serious consequences for deserting if he had stayed in his home country of America. He never thought he would leave his home state of Oklahoma. That's a fascinating tale. It's been a very, very colourful week for news.
Absolutely. It's been a nightmare week for fathers this week. Firstly, of course, we had these funeral of the soldier David Pierce, killed by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan, father of two young daughters, an 11-year-old and a 6-year-old, who now have no daddy, which is an absolute tragedy. Then, of course, the next day we had the baby in the suitcase in the pond, which was an absolute shocker of a story. And then, of course, the weekend, things just continue to get worse and worse with the horrible discovery by a country policeman, senior constable Peter Willett, who was actually called to attend an accident, only to find that his 17-year-old son was dead in the passenger seat. That's in Glen Innes in northern New South Wales. And then, of course, there's another story coming out of the United States, another horror show of another soldier returned from active duty in Iraq to find his 18-month-old daughter dead in the attic, and the neighbours complaining about the bad smell. So it's been a shocking week for fathers. Now, with me in the studio this morning, as well as John Stapleton, who introduced the show, I have Greg Andresen. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, guys and listeners.
And, of course, I have rock and pop Peter Vandervoort. Morning, Peter.
Good morning, Ian. Good morning, all. Good to be here. Yes, could I just mention, you mentioned it earlier, about the little boy in the suitcase. I think for fathers certainly, but for everyone, and especially for him, of course, that's a terrible, sad state of affairs. This poor little two-year-old, defenceless two-year-old boy, was actually on a visit with his mother. He has been living with the paternal grandparents for some time, and he was on a visit with his mother, who was obviously unable to cope with him, and she ended up doing away with him, unfortunately.
Yeah,
and
murdering him is the word.
Murdering
Peter.
Him, yes. I didn't want to say the word, but that's basically what she's done, or alleged to have been done. And, you know, when are we going to learn giving the children to one or other parent who has obviously got problems, defenceless children, cutting the other parent out and putting these kids at great risk, and often on the basis of the gender, which is mostly the mother has the children. And in this case, that mother should have had supervised contact. And I can just talk about another case on the weekend where a judge has just allowed a woman who also murdered her child, drowned the child, allowed her to walk free on the basis that she has some depressive illness. Again, there was an estranged husband involved, and she probably felt that this was the way to get back at the father. The judge was satisfied on that day. This is what the judge's words, that the woman's capacity to think rationally was temporarily suspended, depriving her of the capacity to consider the moral or legal consequences of her behaviour. Her defective reasoning enabled her to form a belief that to achieve relief from the pain and grief she was experiencing, it was a reasonable course of action for her to take her own life, and since she could not consider her son living without her, that it was also okay to take his life as well. Now, she didn't take her own life. She murdered her son. and didn't take her own life, and yet the judge was satisfied that her inability to see her son as a separate psychological and physical entity was a manifestation of her illness. I have no doubt she has felt and will continue to feel her own personal sense of responsibility for her actions, and that she is deeply remorseful for the pain she has caused the boy's father, Justice Fullerton said. Justice Fullerton stressed that the woman had been acquitted of any criminal responsibility for her son's death and was free to leave the court.
Well, that in itself has got to be criminal, doesn't it? I mean, letting a murderer
Absolutely.
Go free. And, of course, the Australian Bureau of Statistics does prove conclusively that the person most likely to kill a child is its mother. And when I heard of little Dean Shillingsworth's body being found by other children floating around in a pond in a suitcase, my immediate thought was it's most likely its mother, and then as the week unfolded, of course, it turned out to be her. And, of course, the most horrifying thing about that case is that the case had been reported to DOCS, whose responsibility it is to look after the welfare of at-risk children, and, of course, DOCS did absolutely nothing about it. I think that there was an order on the 11th of October this year, but it was ignored. They stressed that they had no power to actually do anything about it, and, of course, now that little toddler, that little Australian, is dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awful. That's awful.
Yeah, it doesn't get much worse than that. It's been, like I said earlier, it's been an absolute horror week for the fathers of the world this week. There's three cases we've just mentioned where mothers have murdered their children, basically, which is a nightmare scenario, and people basically have to wake up. I mean, all this domestic violence that the government's been sponsoring the campaign against men, they need to wake up to the fact that women are just as violent, and when it comes to children, women are more likely to harm children than men. Especially fathers. Fathers are statistically, a child is at its safest when it's in the care of its biological father. That is something that is sorely missing from this debate, and the evidence of the last week backs it up to the hilt.
Greg, you know a lot about these statistics on domestic violence and violence against men especially.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Australian Bureau of Statistics shows that men are twice as likely as women to be victims of violence, yet all the campaigns we see are about violence against women. There are no campaigns about violence against men, and yet they suffer twice the violence that women do. And there's no campaigns of violence against children. Have you guys ever seen an Australian campaign?
No.
Violence against children, Australian says no, and yet these are the people that need protection more than men, more than women.
Absolutely.
Is the poor, innocent kids in our country that are defenceless, and we've just seen three tragic examples of the most horrific violence against these poor young Australians.
Yeah, defenceless.
Really. And there's no campaigns at all. There's an absence of that. It's really shocking.
Well, yeah. There is actually, because what the women's groups have cleverly done is they've made it mothers and children, violence against mothers and children. They've lobbed the children in with the mothers.
Yeah, well, that's what they do, but the government hasn't done that with their campaign, but that is what the feminists try and do, and that they do that so that they can play clever with statistics, because what you do is when you add mothers and children in together, there are always more mothers and children than there are men. So whatever statistics you pull out, you can always show that mothers and children are worse off than men, because you just do the maths.
That's right.
Yeah. It's a very clever way of playing.
Simple demographics, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, no, shocking stuff going down there. Okay, well, we'll be back in a moment.
Yeah.
Yes, as we were saying, a nightmare week all around the world for offences against fathers, and of course the sympathies of dads on the air go out to all of the fathers involved in all of those horrific cases of child murder. We extend our sympathies to the fathers and to the fathers especially of those poor children, and of course to the whole family basically as well. Now, our very own rock and pop Peter Vandervoort has been away, as we've announced previously, been off scurrying around the world collecting a treasure trove of interviews, which we're going to be airing on today's program. We're going to have an interview with Mary Cleary of Amen, which we will be playing shortly. However, we won't be doing that right now.
Yeah, first up, we should note that you can buy the book Family Court Hell from our website, dadsontheair.net, by Mark Harris. This is the story of one man's harrowing story of frustration and determination as he battled for access right to the young daughters following the bitter breakup of his marriage. Incredibly, his was a journey that spanned almost 10 years with 133 hearings by 33 judges, and which reportedly cost the taxpayer almost £1 million. That's in the UK. What should have been a simple contact dispute somehow resulted in this innocent family man effectively being criminalised by the family courts, resulting in a stretch on the wing of the infamous Pentonville prison, which housed convicted murderers, terrorists, gun runners and drug dealers. And it looks like we'll very soon have Joshua Key. He is the author of The Deserter's Tale. Now, The Deserter's Tale, Why I Walked Away from the War in Iraq. In 2002, a young man from Oklahoma signed up with the US Army to provide a better life for his family. A year later, Private First Class Joshua Key was sent to Iraq. He quickly discovered the war did not mean fighting terrorists and evildoers as he had expected. Instead, he saw American soldiers beat, maim and shoot Iraqi civilians with little or no provocation. And we have Joshua Key on the line now. Are you there, Joshua?
Yes.
Oh, look, thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air. It's a privilege to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
No, what an amazing story. Anyone who wants to read this story, The Deserter's Tale, Why I Walked Away from the War in Iraq, is available for sale in Australia through Text Publishing and should be available in most bookshops. Now, I just think for people who haven't heard any of this story, could we start at the very beginning? You were just working in Oklahoma. You never really thought you would stray from where you grew up, did you?
No, I sort of had the conception when I first met my wife, she used to laugh because I would always say that I planned on living there for the rest of my life in the same town of Guthrie. So,
which is a very small and fairly ordinary town from what I can gather.
Oh, yeah, I would say about as ordinary as most.
Now, what led you to join up with the U.S. Army?
It was 2002. Me and my wife was pregnant with my third child. We already had two children. We were pretty economic slumps, I would say, all across the state of Oklahoma at the time. You couldn't find no job that was worth it or one that you'd get benefits from. It was pretty cutthroat. So I did what I had seen in high school, what the billboard showed, what I seen on commercials on TV, and that was go check out the U.S. Army recruiting station.
And you never intended to actually go and fight, did you?
No, even when I first went, I took their test, I signed a contract that said I'd be at a non-deployable base and be put at be a bridge builder, and that I would be stationed in the continental United States, excluding Hawaii and Alaska. So I thought it was pretty concrete, and it was coming from a military person, you know, military uniform. So.
And none of that meant anything when it came to the crunch?
No, I would say none of it meant anything at all. So.
And is that typical of a lot of American soldiers, that they really didn't intend going to Iraq, that they suddenly found themselves being sent basically against their wishes?
I would say for the majority. I mean, I think that out of the guys I served with, I would say 98% of us, we were all sort of slandered into the deal, you know, said, oh, we could do something else, but then we all just got thrown in to be, you know, demolitions and landmines. So we all had, were expected, I guess, that at that time nothing would really throw you for the jumps after what's happened previous. So.
And this is a fairly traditional thing in the U.S., isn't it? It's a way of lifting your family out of poverty is to join the Army.
I mean, that's what you hear and that's what you see. So, I mean, it was I seen it as the only way out. You know, we were stuck. There was no way of making a good life for myself or my family. We didn't have health care, so the only thing I seen that offered the things that we needed was the Army at the time.
And what was your reaction when you first realized that you were being sent to Iraq?
Well, at first, I wasn't happy about it. I wasn't one that was jumping up and down, you know, glad to go to Iraq. But I was, I understood the cause. I understood the reason. Weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein's an evil tyrant. I understood that there was something there that had to be dealt with, and I seen it as, I'll take care of it rather than my children, so let's go.
And because the president at the time, or the still the president, you know, was right behind it, and you thought it was your patriotic duty, basically.
Yes, you know, my wife laughs at me. We laugh at each other because at that time I would have thought, I thought that the president couldn't lie, you know, that whatever he says is golden, so.
Well, Australia is also in Iraq, and much of the population here, as I believe much of the population in America, is actually opposed to the war, but we're there as well. What are Australian soldiers facing when they go over there? What hits them?
Well, I never seen an Australian soldier with all my time in ground in Iraq at certain places, especially on the front lines. I never was with any, so I don't know what they're coming into face with. But I know that the same situations, I'm sure, or at least I hope that things ain't being conducted in the way that we was conducting them. So, I mean, it's still, I consider it, you know, I always look at it as another day in paradise, but in one sense you look at it as another day in hell, so.
Now, for people who have no idea, can you just explain what a day was like as an American soldier in Iraq? What did your day consist of?
The majority of the days were we would conduct raids on Iraqi. I look at it as civilians. I never found what was supposed to have been there, which was terrorists or caches of weapons. We conducted that on a daily basis. I can run through one of them with you if you'd like.
Yeah, please.
That is just we would go to the door with usually a squad team, which is 5 to 6 men. We would blow the front door off, usually blow it in. We'd run inside. Take all males over to us. It was over, if they're over 5 foot tall, they're sent outside. They get zip cuffed, get sent off for interrogations. Why, me and usually my guys were inside the house completely destroying anything that's locked, turning things over, looking for weapons. On the majority of the time, we would take what we want, such as jewelry, cash. It was a pretty well free-for-all. Never found what was supposed to have been there. So.
And really, you had no impression that these families that you were raiding in Iraq were guilty in any way?
No, I mean, you know, just for being there, I guess, is the way we looked at it. But I mean, as far as them being involved in something, there was no evidence of it at that time. I mean, you know, even if there had been previous evidence, there was still none of that. So,
I just read a couple of sentences from the book. This is one of the most moving passages in the whole book, The Deserter's Tale. One of the things that disturbed me the most in the house raids was having to run into bedrooms and round up sleeping Iraqi children. I couldn't help imagining how my own children would react if armed soldiers from another country burst into their rooms and tore them from their bed. I was supposed to keep my guns trained on the children when I woke them, got them out of bed and marched them outside. I couldn't do it. Though I could never point my M249 at a child. I would tap them gently on the shoulder and the poor kids would leap from bed, petrified, screaming like the world was ending. That's what it was like.
Yes. Yeah, that was exactly what it was like. Trauma on both sides of the ball game, I would say. So.
And is there a feeling now amongst American soldiers over there that they really do wonder what on earth they're doing there?
Oh, I'm sure there is. I mean, there's a lot presently in Canada, a lot, you know, over 10,000 deserters in the United States, as well as lots of emails I receive. And I would say that's a big, it was the question when I was there, what are we there for? And I know it's still the question now. Nothing, nobody knows the real reason, so.
No, it's incredible. And what's your view, having been there, what's your view of the rights and wrongs of us being in Iraq?
Well, I would see it as, at that time, I thought there was the potential threat. Of course, shortly after, it was considered there was no potential threat of weapons of mass destruction. I see it at that time that I mean, well, I used to laugh when I was there sleeping in Saddam Hussein's palaces. There was a guard tower every 20 yards, so, I mean, obviously he was pretty scared for his own life. I think it would have been a matter of time, and it could have been, you know, I know he was a ruthless dictator and he should have been dealt with, but I think if they should have stayed out of the matter until things worked its way out. I don't think there was weapons of mass destruction, al-Qaeda terrorists inside Iraq. I think it was pretty free of that at that time, so...
Right, and in fact, one of the ironies of this whole war is that the intervention has actually acted as a sort of centrifuge, or it's really encouraged al-Qaeda and all these groups to go to Iraq.
Well, I used to look at it as, you know, being American, being in war, and being there, I seen it as our country put us in the melting pot of hell. They put us in a place where every country around us hate us just because we're Americans, not because of who we are or who we are as an individual. They hate us because of who our government is.
And that hatred is really very, very strong now, isn't it?
Yes, yes. I mean, I was there in 2003. I could only imagine what the hatred would be now.
Yeah. And you, when you walk down a street there, what was the reaction from people, you know, in the stalls and shops and so on?
It would be different. You know, I have nightmares of going through the markets, especially in Ramadi, and you would have a lot of the butchers, you know, pointing their knife to their own neck and sort of slitting their throat and pointing at you. You would have some happy, some glad. You would have, but you could never tell if they really were or they weren't. I talked with a lot of Iraqi civilians on many different occasions, ones that I talked with on more than one occasion. And I looked at it as they're just like us. You know, they're poor. They're people. They're just like me, trying to make ends meet. Of course, there's a few bad in the bunch, but I'd say there's a few bad in every bunch. So.
And one of the most vivid parts of the book is when you actually returned to America and then decided to desert. Can you just talk about that?
Well, when it happened, I got a two-week leave from Iraq. I was supposed to return back with an undetermined amount of time. When I got home, it was, I don't know how it all came about. I know it was the things that I witnessed, the different things that I seen in Iraq that pushed me to my decision. I completely decapitated heads from innocent civilians getting murdered. But I knew that I didn't know what the media had thought. I didn't know what the world had thought. The only thing that I had knew was it was immorally and wrong to myself. I mean, that was completely something that was against everything I stood for since I could, since birth. So it was a... when it happened, it was, it's a shock. You have to leave your guys there. You know, that was the part that I still deal with now. But I live every day knowing that I did walk away from it and choose the path that I did choose rather than... I hear a lot that you took the easy road, and I laugh at people because the easy road would have been going back to Iraq doing the things I was doing. I've obviously took the hard one by all the things I go through now. So.
And what do you mean by that? What are you going for now?
Well, I'm applying for refugee status in Canada. My refugee claim was denied over a year ago, which is in the appeals process now. It's still it's a long road, it's a hard road, and it's a, I see it as if a country would stand by their agreements with the Geneva Convention and international law, then it wouldn't be a problem, but it's people have to stick by with what they do.
And you believe the Geneva Convention's being broken every day in Iraq?
I would say yes, on probably a very big scale. You know, just look at all the innocent civilians that have died there, it's as well as all the innocent soldiers on all battlefields, because... nobody knows the real reason why they're there, so they're all innocent. So,
and really, thousands and thousands of people have died in what's essentially an unnecessary war.
Yes, you know, it's immoral. It's based on lies. It's different. You know, I even go back to when I joined the Army. If they would have told me the truth whenever I signed the dotted line and said that you would have to do whatever your president tells you to do, whether regardless of right or wrong, regardless of your morals, then, you know, I think a lot of American soldiers would take a lot deeper look into it.
And they are. Look, one of the more vivid passages in the book is when you're fleeing and you're living in a car in a parking lot on this side of the border. Can you just talk about that?
We were on the run. We lived in hiding in Philadelphia for 14 months, which at first... when we got there, we had nothing. You know, you can't go to no one and ask for any help because you're scared that they want your driver's license and run your number. So it was, you just have to make it. It was very, very hard. It was very paranoid. I don't know how so many are doing it now. For the 14 months that I was there, it was complete, it was chaotic, you know, especially when you see the war machine keep turning in such a sense. You know, you're not hearing the truth, you're just seeing the lies, and it keeps going, and then you're having to run for your life rather than go to prison or go back. So.
And there was a man that used to look after this parking lot at night, a security guard who was very kind to you, I gather. Can you just describe that? You had three young children, you're living in a car, this is in your own country, on the run in your own country. Can you just describe the kindness of strangers, I guess?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was very kind because I guess he wasn't allowed really to let anyone sleep overnight in the parking lot, but he would always make an exception for me. He was very considerate, you know, one of the very few, I would have to say, that was just considered out of the kindness of their heart, didn't ask many questions. He would always come wake us up in the morning and tell us to leave before his superiors came. It was an honest act of honesty.
And how were the children coping at this stage?
I think it was very, it was rough for him, especially in hiding in Philadelphia, because we lived in motels for that, primarily that 14 months. So you always have the be quiet issue, you know, you always have to keep them locked. I was very paranoid and scared, like I wouldn't just take him to the park. I mean, it was pretty locked up, quiet. I think it was very confusing for them. I mean, I think now they're just now coming out of that confusion and starting to live their normal lives again, so.
Right, so they're back in the schools in Canada and getting
on
with their education.
Schools, you know, they're back to where they're starting to excel rather than be behind, and it's always the question of when can they see their family and stuff of that nature. But
right, and can you just describe that day that you passed over into Canada?
We passed over by Niagara Falls. It was a very tense, you know. I had a few different options. You know, my option was I knew I seen a bridge, so I figured either I'd jump in the water and swim across, but I seen ice chunks floating, so me and my wife sort of laughed at each other. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know whether to expect an American checkpoint prior to getting there, so we was on our toes. When we got to the Canadian border, they asked what we was coming to Canada for. We told them to visit a friend. They asked how long. We just told them 7 days because that's what my lawyer said to do. Then he said, why'd we have all this luggage? Because we had a minivan on the top. We had a tote that was full of things. You could see the luggage piled up in the back. And we just said, we have four children. And, you know, he said, have a good time.
Have a good time
in Canada. And they didn't even check for IDs. So.
It's amazing how easy sometimes these things can be. When you look at the president talking about victory in Iraq now, what's your response?
I sort of laugh. I mean, that's just, I think to anyone in the world that keeps up on any current events or they listen to any of the truth, they would know that that's completely idiotic. I mean, everyone knows that we're not, you know, the United States is not winning there. And it's another Vietnam in its own sense.
And the surge is doomed to failure.
Yes, I mean, that's, you know, I even laugh when I see them. They have a big deal on about, oh, they're going to return 21,000 soldiers. Well, that ain't even as much as the surge you sent, you know, not even a year ago. And you expect for people to be happy. I mean, I would say people would be happy when they're all home and all in safety where they should be.
And you never expected anything like this. You never expected to be a deserter or to be a, you never expected any of this to happen to you.
Oh, no. No, I would have, even from the time when I was a kid, I never thought I would have left Guthrie, Oklahoma, to the point where I got married. Even the Army, I just thought I would get out, go to welding school, learn to become a welder like I wanted, build bridges in the Army, and live a nice life. It's took a wild turn. I mean, I live an unpredictable life. It seems to go up and down on a daily occasion. Of course, I suffer with post-traumatic stress from the war, so I deal with that on a daily occasion. So it's a long road.
Yeah, I gather from your book you still have nightmares and all of that. Do you mind talking a bit about that?
No, it's just, you know, when I was in Iraq, I witnessed four Iraqi civilians with their heads decapitated from gunfire. I have a lot of nightmares of just a lot of Iraqi heads rolling around, things of that nature. I have different flashbacks when I'm in different places. If it's real packed, like Walmart, for instance, I go there. It's real packed. I'm back in Iraq. You know, it's like just like that. Automatic, you're back in Iraq, and then you wake up and you're inside Walmart. It's a very freaky feeling. It's very hard to deal with on some occasions. you have anxiety. You know, I'm short with my kids compared to before. I wasn't short with them. You know, same with my wife. So it's a lot of dealing.
And this is a trauma, a personal trauma that's multiplied tens of thousands of times with all the soldiers over there. Is there something you could say to them, or you would like to say to them, or?
Well, I'd like to say, you know, I hope that the United States government fulfills its obligations of taking care of its veterans. I mean, I know right now there's been reports, and it's already leaking, that it's terrible for the guys when they come back, and I hope that they receive the treatment they need. I don't see how any one of us could go there, witness what we witnessed, whether you were the one like myself that was actually on the front lines witnessing it, or if you were just back at the base camp hearing about it. I mean, I don't see how we all could come back and not have some effect from it, and I hope that we all, they receive what they need, and they come back strong. So,
and just to sum up the whole experience, what would you say? It's just been a terrible mistake, or what?
No, you know, I would never change my past. I look at it as my eyes have been opened, I mean, in many different ways, and I just go one day to the next, to take it to the fullest. I fight for what I believe, and I believe that we should be allowed to stay in Canada. The Canadian government should allow us, and that all troops should be out of Iraq and be in their homes where they should be. So.
And there's a section in the book where you imagine that you're locked in a room with George Bush, and what you would say to him. What would you say?
Well, I would, if I could pass my nightmares and my flashbacks and things over to him, and I always laugh because I have to be honest, there wouldn't be too much talking. I would just use him as a punching bag more on a consecutive basis. But
dear, oh dear. Yes, well, it's yes, I think it's a very easy to sign a bit of paper and send people off to war, but it's very difficult to actually shoot people or to see people being shot.
Yeah, yeah, it's, you know, it's, I would say it's devastating. It's always been devastating. You know, it's, a lot of people tell me, oh, war is war. You witness what you witnessed there. And I look at that as war is war, but it's a lot different when it's against combatant, against soldier, so.
So, Joshua, just any final words that you'd like to say?
No, no, thanks for having me on your show. I hope that, it's all a peaceful world.
Doesn't look like it. That was Joshua Key. He's the author of a new book, The Deserter's Tale, Why I Walked Away from the War in Iraq. No one can read that book and still think we're doing the right thing in Iraq. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air. Thank you.
My girl, my heart, it's so broken. My head's in a whirl. I'm crying, I'm dying, missing my little girl. Oh, it seems to me like the end of the world. Now I thought kidnapping, that it was a crime. And I thought if you'd done it, that you would do time. Yeah, my wife, she left me, she took my child away. But apparently fathers, they have no say. Oh, I'm crying, I'm dying, I'm missing my girl. My heart, it's so broken. My head's in a whirl. I know that she loves me, she'll be missing me so. Mother could do it, I'll never know. Black man, they told me, was against the law. But they made me sign papers or see her no more. The laws, they are crazy, they're just so unfair. My daughter's half mine, but my wife won't share. She's lying, she's trying to take my little girl. The most precious thing to me in the world. She knows what she's doing is cruel and not right. She's using my little girl simply for spite. Every authority, but they won't help my daughter or listen to me. Yeah, they call this justice, but I fail to see. I wish there was someone to help my girl and me. I'm done, I'm missing my girl. My heart, it's so broken. My head's in a whirl. I'm crying, I'm dying, missing my little girl. The most precious thing to me in the world. She's the most precious thing to me in this world.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back. Peter Vandervoort is in the studio with us now. You've just come back from a whirlwind trip around Europe and the UK. Which must have been enjoyable for you. What was the main purpose of the trip while you were over there?
Yes, Greg, look, the main reason for my trip to Europe was to try and gauge what some of the leaders of the international fatherhood movement feel has been achieved in the context of our now more than 30-year fight to achieve some equality and justice for fathers and their children in the family law courts of the Western democracies. Now, one of those leaders is undoubtedly Mary Cleary from the Amen group in Ireland. Mary founded AMEN, which stands for Abused Men, 10 years ago, and has been a tireless campaigner in the fight for recognition of the fact that men and children suffer abuse and violence at the hands of abusive women in a higher proportion to that suffered by women at the hands of abusive men, 41% and 26% respectively. Today's report of women murdering their own children could somewhat support these findings, one would think. Mary was a wonderful host, took us out to dinner, provided transport to and from the airport. She made all the arrangements for our accommodation, and her energy, dedication, enthusiasm and passion for the work she does appears boundless. Mary's offices are located in the town of Navan, which is close to the Irish capital of Dublin. I did the interview with her on the night of an Amen meeting, and you can actually hear some of the Navan church bells chiming in the background. And I met some wonderful people there, including Melissa Corbally, who is a lecturer in nursing at Dublin University. Melissa was conducting interviews with some of the abused men at the meeting as part of a PhD looking at the nature of domestic abuse / violence from the perspective of men who have or were currently experiencing this. Incidentally, AMEN are celebrating their 10-year anniversary this year and have invited anyone interested who is in Ireland on the 10th of December to attend. The theme of this conference is Much Done, More to Do. She guarantees a host of interesting speakers, and if you want to experience the real Irish spirit and hospitality, then I would highly recommend you try and get there. So here's my interview with Mary Cleary.
We're speaking with Mary Cleary from the AMEN organisation in Ireland. Welcome to Dads on the Air, Mary.
Thank you. Thank you. Very welcome.
Could I start by asking you briefly to give a brief history of the AMEN organisation?
Yeah. Well, AMEN was set up by myself back in the end of 97. Before that, I ran a women's group, and I became aware through my work in the hospital that men are victims of domestic abuse too. I was very unhappy with the way that domestic violence was portrayed, as if it were simply and purely something that happened to women. From my experience in the hospital, from, you know, in accident and emergency and fracture clinics, and also, you know, on occasions I would go out in the ambulance to bring in people who had been injured. So I then, you know, ran a public meeting here, did a little bit of research, and wrote letters to the papers, and the media picked it up from there. The letters asked men to come forward and to talk about their experiences as male victims of domestic abuse. From the response to the particular radio show, which is the Gay Byrne show, he ran with this issue for 8 days. Huge numbers of men from all around Ireland, you know, rang up, wanted to go on air and speak anonymously. I then decided to open up, initially it was my home, a phone in my kitchen as a helpline. And I suppose it grew from there. That was back in 97.
So it's almost 10 years since it's been going. I understand you have your 10th anniversary coming up in December. So you see yourself mainly as a support group or as a political lobby group as well, perhaps? Or what is your main role, do you think? Because the AMEN title, what does that also mean?
Well, AMEN means abuse men.
Abuse men.
And
right.
We're talking here about men and their children who are victims of domestic abuse. That's... But, you know, I suppose that's our primary issue. However, you know, that is, you cannot, there are other issues for men who find themselves in situations where they are victims of domestic abuse. For instance, if they try to leave the situations, they will have a difficulty in seeing their children. There are all kinds of issues around separation, divorce, maintenance, mortgage, you know, a whole host of issues like this. So I suppose we have expanded. And I suppose in many ways we've always dealt with those issues. We are a support group. We run a helpline here. It's a national helpline. We also meet with men and their families. We meet with them individually by appointment. We run group meetings on Tuesday nights where people come here from different parts of the country. And, you know, they share their experiences and they also look for information and advice. We lobby also. We lobby government. We make all kinds of submissions about our issues to, you know, review groups on the Constitution, all party committees and the like. So oftentimes we're invited to come in and do oral presentations to these people. We regularly contact our public representatives about the issues, and nowadays we sit on a number of boards, like Legal Aid Board, like Court Services Board. We're funded a little by Commission for Victims of Crime, and we get a little bit of project-based funding also.
So, excuse me, so most of your funding, is it from government funding, or is it from donations by organisations or something?
Oh, well, it's mostly project-based funding from the government. But this year, we've worked with health authorities for over a year in drawing up a plan, a three-year plan. We looked at issues like budgetary issues and the like. So for the very first time, I believe most probably anywhere in the world, the HSE have decided to take us on board.
HSE?
The HSE is the health authority. Okay, Health Service Authority, they have now taken us on board and they fund our initiative. Now, which enabled us to employ a number of people who work here with us. Now we've got secretarial, we've got an administrator, we've got a couple of support workers, we've got a person who helps prepare men for going to court, and we also, where possible, accompany men to the courts. We've got another support worker, a different kind of support worker, who helps men with their, you know, kind of emotional issues and housing, and will direct them to social workers and, you know, schools and the like, if there are issues around school reports and the like. So we're a very busy office indeed.
I've noticed it myself. It's very well run. There's a number of people working here and all the equipment here. You're probably one of the luckiest groups in the world today, because they're all struggling mainly. So it's wonderful to see that. Mary, what do you see as being the main obstacles faced by the fatherhood movement in Ireland in 2007?
The biggest obstacles, I suppose, many men become frustrated because, you know, the wheels of justice really move slowly. And myself, I noticed a very big change in attitudes from 97, where, you know, oftentimes one was met with ridicule, where one was met with disbelief and so on. That has changed, and people are now accepting, yes, that men are getting a bad time, and that, you know, there should be a balance here, and, you know, the pendulum has swung too far, and it needs to come back a bit, like in the middle, and that fathers are getting a bad time. I suppose the main obstacles for them are the fact that they don't have the funding to run their organizations, and to, you know, to have the staff there, you know, because without money you can't have the staff. So it's a bit of a vicious circle, really. You know, we need more in Ireland of what we've got here. We are meant to be creating some sort of a model of excellence, which eventually will be rolled out in different other parts of the country. So I suppose really the lack of funding is a very, very big obstacle for the groups, for the men's groups. And there are a number of them here in Ireland.
And how do you see the movement on a global scale, from your perception?
Well, on a global scale, I believe that the support that we are getting from our government here for our AMEN organisation is not happening anywhere else in the world.
No.
So I believe what we are doing here is cutting edge. You know, I've met with men in Canada, I've met with men in the United States, I've met with men in, you know, all the continental countries, guys from England, Scotland, Wales, and the issues for them are mostly the same. You know, we hear that men are being discriminated against, particularly in areas such as family law. You know,
Child support as well?
Well, you know, most men that come to us, they do want to see their children. They want to support their children, but they also want to see their children. And they don't have an issue with child support at all, but they do want to see their children. Where they have the problem is, you know, seeing their children as often as they would like to, and they have problems with the custody and the access and so on, just the same as you've got in Australia.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And New Zealand and any other place you wish to name it.
What about the other groups in Ireland? Do they work well together, the fatherhood groups? I mean, every country has some problems, and there's a great diversity, but in Ireland, are they any different, or do you see that diversity there as well?
Yes, well, I suppose we all have, you know, difference of opinion as to how we should run our groups, and, you know, we do all come together, you know, at times such as conference times. You know, if somebody's hosting a conference, the rest of us will go there and support it. You know, they do what they do, and I do as best as I can, you know. And, you know, I do think that groups, no matter where they're placed, that they do provide a service for men out there who need that kind of a service. It takes men out of their isolation, and the men, when they come to this particular group that I know, AMEN, they do open up, and you know, they want to be heard. And you know, there was a student who came to us. She was doing her master's. She was the first student who ever came to us. She was a social worker who goes back to college to do her master's, and what she said afterwards was, what surprises me more than anything is the readiness and the willingness of men to speak out when they are given a safe forum. So that's what we try to provide, is a safe forum where men feel comfortable about talking about their experiences and sharing them and learning from others. So, of course, there are differences of opinions in the groups worldwide. But basically, I suppose, our issues are the same. We all want to help out in some way and relieve the suffering that many men experience. You know, there have been guys who've been in touch with us who've taken their own lives, and I believe that if those guys had received the kind of support that they that the women's groups are getting, for instance, so the women are getting who come to women's groups, that, you know, they might not have chosen that option.
Are the women's groups in Ireland getting government funding?
The women's groups are very well funded. I mean, they get millions every year. I mean, we probably get 0.5% of the kind of funding that they're getting. And, you know, they have the free helplines costing, you know, one helpline that I know of, they were given $1.5 million. Mm. You know, you have all kinds of free phones, you know, that you have. Of course, they've got the staff because they've got the money to employ the staff. You know, they have a service, and rightly so, where they can, you know, support women who go to court. You know, in all counties of Ireland, there's at least one refuge for women. Recently, a guy who lives in the southern part of the country, he wrote a letter to his health authority, and he asked about what kind of support was there for men who are victims of domestic abuse and what kind of support there was for women. Well, they wrote back to him and they said, unfortunately, there is nothing for men. However, we fund something like 7 or 8 different groups for women in that particular country. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a shame and a disgrace in the 21st century that people have to travel such long distances to come to a meeting here. And, you know, they ring up, the guys ring up because they don't know. And they want to know, like, where do you meet in our local town? And I'm saying, we meet here in Avon. That's all we've got at the moment, you know. And when you have guys who have to get on trains and buses and drive maybe for 4 hours to come to a meeting, I think it's a bloody disgrace, you know.
Yeah, it's not land like Australia where all the women's groups are well-funded and the fathers' groups are basically battling. We are speaking with Mary Cleary in Ireland. She's the founder and president or director of the AIMN organisation. We'll be back after the break.
My worst fears.
with Mary Cleary from the Amen Group in Ireland. Mary, you have just recently co-authored a book with an interesting title, That Bitch.
Yes.
It's only just become available. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, the book will be available in the shops from the 27th of this month, which is September. It is also available on Amazon.com. Hopefully, eventually, it will be available in bookshops in Australia. But at the moment, yeah. I've co-authored this book with a guy from England. His name is Roy Shepherd. We've worked on this book together over the last maybe 9 months. It looks at issues around male abuse and women who perpetrate. It also tells the reader how to protect themselves against such abuse, and it is how to protect yourself against women with malicious intent. You know, some of the chapters will look at, I suppose, why did they pick on you? Also about children as weapons of male destruction. It also looks at the psychologies of malice. And it looks at, psychiatric disorders that might be possible contributors to bad behavior.
Yes.
How do you get out of a relationship? How do you get out of a relationship, particularly when you have children?
Exactly.
You know, and I suppose finally it looks at things like getting back your esteem. That chapter is called Full Esteem Ahead. So, that really basically is what the book is about, and
An interesting title. How did you arrive at that, using that title? A bit controversial, perhaps, or
a little bit controversial, but that's intentional. Mm-hmm. And it has a very nice graphic, a red-haired woman, which kind of what comes to mind when you think of red hair? You think of a feisty woman, at least, strong women, powerful women, perhaps controlling or whatever. Mm-hmm. The title, That Bitch. Yes, it has so far evoked from some people a strong response, but it is not intended to be, anti-woman in any way, because, situations described here would also apply to women who are in situations, let's call them situations, women who are victims of domestic abuse. It also has checklists around good relationships versus bad relationships, things to watch out for when you meet, when you get into a new relationship. I would say to guys, be diligent, keep your eyes open. Sometimes they don't, and oftentimes they don't. But for instance, if there's an element of control, if you meet somebody who tries to, isolate you from your family and friends, and this oftentimes happens, And when I go into schools, to second level schools, I talk to 16, 17, 18-year-olds, boys and girls, and I talk to them about relationships and about that element of control, because boys experience this, girls also experience it. And I say to those people, imagine that you meet one of those people, initially, you think it's, well, he or she loves me and they just want me all to themselves and so on. But imagine that you marry one of those people, and imagine you have children with one of those people. And just imagine how that vice tightens, until you're almost asphyxiated, how then do you get out of that relationship? So those are the sort of things to watch out for. So there is like a due diligence checklist here also.
Yes, it's very important you learn that before you get into those relationships, so at least you see the warning signs, if you're still thinking with your brain, that is. Just on another area, there's some excellent women leaders now who provide very strong voices in support of the fatherhood movement. It's not unlike the feminist movement of the past, which also recognised the importance of strong male voices speaking on their behalf. What, if any, role do you think women are going to play in the debate in the coming years?
Well, again, I suppose, you know, many of our supporters would be women, and many of those women have sons, they have brothers, they have colleagues at work. So many of those women know, and they know instinctively from their life experience, that men too can be at the receiving end of violence and abuse and alienation from their children. And I think that women who know this, they really have a duty to speak out. And will they be at the centre of the debate? Perhaps they will. Already we have a number, as you rightly said, of women who have spoken out. You have Jan Brown in Maine. You have this Senator Ann Coulds in
Canada.
I mean, I've met Ann. I've shared a platform with her at the University of Southern Maine, and she is the most endearing woman that you have ever met. Yes. And she is a wonderful advocate for men. We have here in Ireland Professor Patricia Casey. We have, you know, in the past, in the recent past, we have Aaron Pitsay.
Yes.
And, you know, there are others. Yeah, but you also have Kathy Young, who writes, I think Kathy is based in Boston or Massachusetts.
Right.
She has written a book about these issues. The name eludes me right now, but she regularly has a column in one of the major papers in her state, and where she writes about fatherhood and father's issues. So already, we're at the we're in the middle of that kind of debate already.
Yeah.
You know,
and we all think it's important too, of course. And like you said, every man that's been affected this way also has a mother who pines for what their son's going through.
Yeah, well, a lot of these people, again, you know, many of these relations, they you know, they don't like to interfere because, you know, sometimes they say, well, you know, if I interfere and these people get back together again, I'm going to be the worst in the world.
Yeah.
You know, as you've seen here tonight, you know, you have a number of women around. You have a number of women around in these offices.
Yes.
You know, the guys don't care who they speak to when they call our helpline. And they're delighted, many of the men who come to me, they're delighted to see women around as well.
Yes.
Because they may have had a bad experience with one woman, but it's also important for them to see that all women are not like that. Similarly, so with the book, That Bitch, we're just talking about specific women.
Yes.
We're not talking about all women, because all women are not like that any more than all men are. Bastards, they're not, you know. In fact, what I would like to say here now, that the men who come to us, the reason that the men find themselves in these situations is because they are gentlemen. All of the men who come to us, they are gentlemen in every sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because they are soft, you know, that they find themselves at the receiving end. And they allow themselves to be controlled. You know, they don't see it coming either, you know.
No.
They don't see it coming. It's not, you know, it happens kind of subtly, really, doesn't it? Initially, anyway.
It does.
And it's like, you know, testing the temperature or testing the water or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, again, I suppose it's in all of us to want to control other people, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, and if you're allowed to get away with it, that's the problem.
Do you know of any countries in Europe or indeed the world that you see as having a successful model in place which guarantees that children at least remain in contact with both parents following parental separation?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm told that in certain states in America that this happens, but I'm not sure how it works. That's in theory. I'm not actually sure how it all works in practice. You know, yes, of course, certain countries are held up as being models of, you know, excellence and so on, maybe like Sweden. But from talking to the guys around the world, I don't think that there is a model that, you know, we should be aspiring to right now.
So do you think we've made any inroads in the last 30 years?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been involved in Amen. It's 10 years since I set up Amen, and I see huge changes. You know, I can see changes in regarding the social workers and how they deal with these issues, and I think they are now listening. They are listening.
Mm-hmm.
I can see our public representative want to know. And things happen, you know, very slowly, unfortunately. It doesn't happen fast enough for a lot of us. But I do see, huge changes in attitudes, you know, from the media, from, you know, when we run conferences, you know, we have all the major television stations reporting. You know, you have reports in the major newspapers. And yes, I do see huge changes. I see the students who are coming to us from all the disciplines in universities, third level colleges, and they're now writing their dissertations and their essays and their theses. We even have a number of, you know, PhD students who are focusing on this particular issue. And that to me is heartening. You know, all of those young people in the next couple of years, they will be out of coalface. And, you know, I think that they are the people who are really going to make a difference,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah, the young people. Yeah.
So, what actions do you consider to have been the most effective so far in the last 30 years that have really made a major difference already, perhaps?
What actions? I suppose the fact that men are now kind of getting together and grouping and, you know, making representations to their public representatives, the fact that they're writing letters in the paper, articles, letters to the paper, articles in the paper, that sort of thing helps. It creates, it conscientizes the general public. You know, to influence legislation. And we have had a number of, for instance, just here recently, a number of court decisions favouring fathers. You know, we had a situation for a number of years where men could be removed from their home with an interim emergency order, and it might be 2.5 years before they would get a hearing. Just a few years back, there was a challenge that went to the Supreme Court about that particular order, and the five Supreme Court judges, they decided that order, as it stood, was repugnant to the Constitution of Ireland, and it was thrown out. Now, it was reintroduced, you know, in a different guise a short time later, but it means that a man now will be heard. He will be given an opportunity to be heard within 8 days, right?
Okay.
And the other thing is, some of those men who have been ejected from their homes in such a manner, they have now been given permission by the High Court here in Ireland to seek compensation from the state. So that's kind of major, really, if you like.
They are major issues. Yeah. We're speaking with Mary Cleary in Ireland. We'll be back after the break.
I love you, Daddy. I wish your pain would go away.
I watch you hold on. And hide your face from the world. In all of your hiding, your silence grows deeper. In all of your silence, I know your heart really cries. So how can you give me the love that I need when you just don't know how, when you're just too afraid? Broken father, can you hear me? Can you just let me in? Broken father, can you hug me? Can you just take my hand? Because I accept you, I forgive you, and I'm trying to understand. To know what you're thinking and all you are feeling, and though you are so tough, I know your heart really cries. So how can you give me the support that I need when you just don't know how, when you're just too afraid? Please. Just
love you, Daddy.
With Mary Cleary. Mary, what part, in your view, has the media played in the debate so far?
Well, a very big part indeed, and I suppose that's free advertising for us. So with the media, when they say jump, I say how high, right?
All right.
Yeah, because you respond to them immediately. Anyway, you know, from their perspective, they're looking for new subject matter.
Yes.
As I said, from our perspective, we're getting free advertising. So we've had huge media interest in Amen from day one. You know, we've had documentaries made about our issues. I've been to BBC in London. They cover our conferences. If anything new comes up, they want to know. Regularly we hear from journalists who are looking for, you know, some new angle to write about. And the other thing that's important too is to have a bank of men who are prepared to speak out, but anonymously, of course, and it has to be anonymous, because, as you know, those cases in Ireland and England are heard in camera.
Right.
I'm not sure about what happens in your country, but I'm sure it's the same. So the media have played a very big part in highlighting and in creating awareness about our issues. And oftentimes it is through the media or in the media that guys will find a contact number.
Yes.
And what actually happens here is when there is an article in the newspaper, or if one of us, if we're on the radio, we get a new wave of calls coming through, you know. And you might have some people who will say, I had your number in my diary or some such place for the last 2 years. In some cases, it might be under the mattress, you know. And there are other cases where I'll get an call from a really angry woman who will tell me, I found your number under my husband's mattress, you know. You know. Well, I didn't give it to him. Or I found a leaflet from Amen, and I said, but then he could have picked that up anywhere in any public library or citizen information centre or whatever, you know. But to answer your question, I am really grateful to the media attention, because it has raised the profile, of course.
Yes,
yeah. Yeah, but it's hard work. It's hard work, because one has to be, you know, in an upbeat manner all the time. You know, you have to sound energized, you know, when you're speaking to the media, passionate, which is what I am anyway.
Yes, absolutely.
But all of that has to come through, you know, and that you believe in whatever you're selling.
Yes.
And in this case, it is Amen and all of our issues. You know.
Do you think there's much of an understanding of the mental health issues involved in this? Because this often comes up, you know, that people suffering from disorders that are just they function quite well in the community, so they're not seen to be suffering from a disorder. But when this situation comes up with children involved, it's often a major problem, we feel.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, when I set up Amen, or shortly after, I had calls from all of the suicide prevention officers in the country saying, we never thought about this as a possible reason as to why men would take their own lives or be depressed. Many of the men who contact us will tell us in graphic detail how they thought about taking their own lives, how I carried a gun around in the car for a week, I sat on the top of a cliff, I sat at the end of the pier, I drove the car out onto a strand and waited for the tide to come in and surround me, I had a hose pipe in the car, I thought about taking my own life. I had a piece of rope. I thought about hanging myself from a tree. But then I thought about my children. You know, as always, but then I thought about my children. So, you know, again, many of the men who make contact with us, they will be depressed. They'll be stressed. You know, they will not be able to function in the workplace. You know, many of them will describe themselves as hazards. You know, hazards in the workplace. You know, if you're an airline pilot and tomorrow you have to, after suffering abuse, and tomorrow you have to fly a plane across the Atlantic, well, God help us all, we better say our prayers before we get on board, you know. Or if you happen to be driving heavy machinery or a train or whatever, or an articulated lorry, or you're anaesthetist in the hospital, you know, or a surgeon, because we've had calls from all of those people, you know. who have other people in their hands, and they're not focused, and oftentimes they're not, or they're depressed, or, as I said, sometimes suicidal. You know, I've heard from men who have attempted to take their own lives and lived. You know, I've heard from relations of men who've taken their own lives, you know, and so on. So it's a very big mental health issue.
Do you think the authorities or the people dealing with it are informed enough to be able to deal with it correctly?
Well, I'm not sure that they're informed enough. But, you know, again, in the health services, we're overworked here.
Yes.
You know, many of them are doing their best. I have heard from you know, people who work in those services, mental health services, and they want to know about these issues because sometimes they will have a patient who might have opened up to them. In other cases, they may have loved ones themselves. You know, I remember getting a call from one woman who worked in the mental health services. She told me about a colleague of hers who said, "I cannot go home tonight again and face that woman." And he was found in the river the next morning, you know, and so on. But I'm not sure that they're informed enough. But, you know, again, I do presentations to all sorts of people, you know, social work, schools, libraries, third level institutions. And, you know, I'm interested in delivering training if anybody's interested in listening. And I think we need to have more of that, really.
Absolutely. Now, 10 years on, the big conference at the end of the year, you better tell us a bit about that, and we'll try and get some of these Australian people involved.
Well, if there's anybody here, any of your listeners here, who happens to be in Ireland around about the 3rd of December, we are hosting our 10th anniversary conference in a hotel near Dublin. It's called Much Done, More to Do. And there is very much more to do. I mean, we are very happy with our achievements, but there is much more to do. The conference is our 10th anniversary, as I said. It will be also thematic to Christmas, and Santa Claus will come and visit everybody in the audience with prezzies on the day. I am the proverbial beggar woman, so I will be going out and I'll be looking for Clarins for men and Nivea for men and Gillette for men and, you know, potpourri for men and candles for men, and everybody gets looked after on the day. But again, it's a lot of work. We hope that it will be well attended, that it will be opened by the Minister for Health. That's my hope. You know, we have a whole host of interesting speakers, you know, who have consented to speak at the conference. So I think it'll be a good day as usual.
We certainly hope so, and we hope many Australians will turn up to try your Guinness. That could be an interesting, having it in a hotel. Yeah, that sounds good. Finally, Mary, to sum up, after being at the coalface for so many years, is there any genuine message of hope that you can give to all those parents around the world who are so cruelly kept separated from their children under the current family justice system?
I would say hang in there, you know. There are people who have said, including a man with whom our support worker went to court yesterday, this man got sole custody of his child. He had been through the ropes. He had been had all kinds of false allegations made against him. But following social work and, you know, psychological evaluations, it was found that, you know, his wife was lying and he's now been given custody of the children. You know, we have, you know, things are improving. We have a number of men now because they stood up and they fought and they were heard and they were listened to eventually. You know, they now have their children in their care. And, you know, one man said to me recently, he's a police inspector. He said, "Oh, it means so much to me when I can say the prayers with the child or do the homework with my children or take my children to football or hurling." I was in his house one evening when his six-year-old threw his arms around his neck and said, "Daddy, I want to be just like you when I grow up," you know, and he hugged him so tightly. Right. And it makes, that's the sort of thing that makes it worthwhile for me to keep going. And sometimes, you know, actually there was a guy again who was in contact with me recently. He was an unmarried father. And he said, "Mary, everybody should have that book. Not that book, this is another little booklet we put together." He said, "I was about to give up and say, you can have it all." And I did say that to her, to the mother. And she said, "If you leave," she said, "the people that I will bring in here, you know, your daughter will not be safe with them." And he said, again, he said, "That gave me strength to stand up and fight." And now she's signed the papers. That, and I now have my daughter, who's 10 years old, living with me. So, you know, I'm not saying that children shouldn't see their mothers. Of course they should see their mothers, but they should also see their fathers. You know, and that child needs a relationship with both parents in order to develop into the kind of a person that we hope our children will develop into, you know.
Absolutely.
But I do see hope. I do see hope. I do see hope. I do see light at the end of the tunnel. Sometimes it's difficult enough to see it, but, you know, there are some cases when that light shines through, you know, and just to see the joy on the father's faces. And I meet with a number of these guys in their homes, and I've met them with their children, and they invite you to communions and confirmations and family events.
Yeah.
Don't always go because one can't.
Of course.
But or we organise parties at Christmas or birthdays or picnics and things like that. And just to see them together, you know, it's just lovely, really.
So there's a lot of positive stories in there.
There's a lot of
Despite all the negative ones.
And we do have some dreadful, awful stories, but there are some good, positive ones also, you know.
Mary, unfortunately, we've run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us on Dad's on the Air today and sharing your thoughts with us. Just before we go, you better give us the details to for people to be able to buy your book again.
Yeah, well, you know, if you want to find out more information about the book, you can go to www.thatbitchbook.com. It is also available to buy on Amazon.com. That's it for us.
We have been speaking with Mary Cleary of the Amen Organisation in Ireland. We'll be back after the break.
And the website. The Amen website is www.amen.ie. Okay.
Thanks, Mary.
And our website is www.dadsontheair.net. And if you're interested in listening to the program today, you can re-listen to that at www.dadsontheair.net. And we'd like to thank our guest, Joshua Key, the author of The Deserter's Tale, and Mary Cleary, the founder of Amen, one of the leading exponents for abused men in the world today. It's a very tumultuous time in Australian politics at the moment with an election coming up.
It is indeed. In today's Telegraph, under the heading Women Want Political Clout, Claire Masters writes, flexible childcare, better birthing choices, mandatory paid maternity leave, and a presence in politics. The platforms of the new single-sex political party, What Women Want. Mothers of all shapes and sizes rallied at Ryde Hospital for the launch of the political party that is looking to change the face of politics. So there we go. The women have actually got themselves their very own political party, totally exclusive of men, nothing to do with blokes, no fellas in there, and it's all totally feminised. Now, if there was a blokes-only party, there'd be people would be up in arms in horror.
What men want.
Well, look, it sounds like a lot of the things they want there are actually what dads want as well. If it was made gender inclusive, we had paternity leave, childcare, it's all stuff that dads and mums want. Let's just make it, well, why not make it for everyone, not just for women?
Well, exactly, and are you wondering if they expect men, they don't want men's votes? I mean, it's a bit strange. I think sexism in politics is not particularly a great step forward, in my opinion.
And don't forget to stay tuned to Dads on the Air in the coming weeks. We have, as always, some of the world's leading commentators on gender and fatherhood, including Tony Coe from the, what's it called again?
The Equal Parenting Council
from
in
the
UK.
Equal Parenting Council. And next week we'll have...
Next week we've got Paul Damon and Damien Litchfield. They run a program called Boys to Be Men in Victoria, which is mentoring for young boys who are falling off the rails. So that'll be a great interview.
We'll be back next week.
With Dads on the Air, we're here 'cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't.